This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. A lethal disease gradually devastating bat populations across the eastern U.S. is slowly spreading in Wisconsin. White nose syndrome and the fungus that causes it have now been confirmed in 8 Wisconsin counties, mostly in the southwestern driftless region of the state. There have also been signs of it spreading into isolated parts of northeast Iowa and southeast Minnesota. UW Platteville biology professor Jeff Hibschman and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Species Management Section Chief Owen Boyle have been studying the issue. They explained to Wisconsin Public Radio's Maureen McCollum why white nose syndrome is a growing concern.
What white nose syndrome is a disease that's caused by a fungus that is not native to the U.S. As best as researchers have been able to determine, it was originally found in Europe and likely brought here to the U.S. Transported accidentally, and introduced first found in a cave in upstate New York in 2006. The fungus doesn't kill the bats directly. The bats that are most impacted by this fungus are what we call cave bats, and these are bats that spend the winter hibernating rather than migrating out of the state. And as you know, bats are insectivores. They eat insects, and thankfully in Wisconsin there are no insects in winter. The way that they cope with that lack of food is by hibernating. And while they're doing that, their metabolisms are much slowed, their core body temperatures drop, and they're not burning energy as quickly. Unfortunately, what the fungus does is continues to wake them up and causes them to burn energy that they wouldn't normally. And unfortunately, they have no way to replace that energy. So basically, by the end of the winter, you're left with bats that in many cases are starving to death or dying of exposure because they run out of energy.
And Jeff, this disease doesn't discriminate. This can impact any bat species. Is that correct?
As Owen indicated, it's just those bat species that are hibernating bats.
Okay.
Here in Wisconsin, we have 7 species of regularly occurring bats, and 3 of those species are migratory bats, so they're not hibernating locally here in the state. And those species have not been impacted to date. But species in eastern North America that hibernate are susceptible to white nose syndrome.
And Owen, you said that a lot of bats, is it true that they come to Wisconsin for the winter? And is there any particular reason why, you know, Wisconsin gets a lot of these out-of-state bats that come to hibernate here in the winter?
Bats across the upper Midwest. Yeah, they can travel quite a ways in the fall looking for hibernacular places to spend the winter. I guess we don't really know, where all the bats that spend the winter in Wisconsin are from. But we do know that in a number of cases now that it's very likely anyway that those bats have come from other places that were infected with white nose syndrome. Because that's pretty likely how the disease got here to Wisconsin.
So now the DNR has confirmed that white nose syndrome is in 5 Wisconsin counties: Grant, Crawford, Richland, Door, and Dane County, mostly in the Southwest. I mean, when you find them, do you find them infected? Are you finding dead bats?
Not so far. So the way that the disease progressed in the eastern states, and we're seeing the same pattern here, is that it usually takes maybe 2 or 3 years after that first initial discovery of the disease before we start seeing the large numbers of bats dying. And so in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, last year was the first year that we found white nose syndrome in the state. It was just at one site. And this year we've now found it, that is, it expanded to 13 more sites, total of 8 counties. So we're at the very early stage of infection here in Wisconsin. So we wouldn't expect to see the large die-offs, at least for another probably couple of years.
And Jeff, down in Grant County, where you are, where Platteville is, like as Owen said, you know, that's where the white nose syndrome was first discovered. And from what I understand, there's been a 70% decrease in the population. Can you explain that number and kind of what you're seeing down in Grant County?
I don't know that we have documented the 70% decrease of bats here in Grant County at this time. That may be more of a figure from the northeastern states. But we would expect, as Owen was suggesting, in the next few years that we would start seeing local declines here in the southwest part of the state. One of the things that's, you know, fortunately the Wisconsin DNR has been very involved in, and I've been involved in here at UW-Platteville in a smaller role, is trying to gather baseline data on bat populations. The DNR has been doing it across the state, and with students here at UW-Platteville, we've been doing stuff very locally around the Platteville area and in southwest Wisconsin, trying to get baseline data on what kind of healthy bat populations look like so that we can kind of accurately document the decline when it begins to take place.
So it might be a way to just really hyper-locally really investigate what's going on and how quickly everything's happening.
Right. I mean, aside from doing wintertime hibernacula counts where individuals can go in and actively count the bats and see how those numbers are declining from year to year, assessing summer populations is a totally different scenario. And that's something that folks are doing in a variety of ways, again, throughout the region where white-nosed syndrome has been found. And that's maybe something that folks, you know, the average kind of homeowner may start to notice in the years ahead as bat populations decline through the region.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about the spread of white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin. My guests are Jeff Hepschman. He's a professor in the Department of Biology at UW-Platteville. And Owen Boyle. He's a Species Management Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So, Owen, there was fungus found, fungus that causes the disease, in Iowa, Dodge, and Lafayette counties. What exactly does that mean if we're just finding the fungus, but we're not necessarily finding bats infected with it?
Well, again, this is a pattern of spread that has been seen in the eastern states as well, and actually even in some of our neighboring states, including Minnesota and Iowa. The annual surveillance that we do is sort of two-parted when our teams go underground to survey the hibernacula during winter when bats are hibernating. They're both looking for signs of the disease, so those characteristic, you know, white fuzzy muzzles and that many people you've seen pictures of infected bats, but they're also taking environmental samples, and so which literally consists of essentially a large Q-tip. You're swabbing cave walls and cave floor, and that sample can then be analyzed through genetic techniques to find and isolate the genetics of the fungus itself. And so those counties where we haven't seen clinical signs of white-nose syndrome yet, but we have found essentially the genetic evidence that the fungus is there, they could stay that way for a few years. And again, this is, they've seen this out east and to the states immediately west of us where we first find the fungus, and it may be a few years before we actually see the full-blown white-nose syndrome in bats themselves.
And, like, when you find it in a cave or if you find the fungus in a mine, is there any way to clean or disinfect the cave?
Not so far, and that is the target of various research projects going on around the nation. There are a number of ways that researchers are trying to tackle the try and slow or even completely control the fungus, and so so far none of the research has been really shown to be able to sort of disinfect the site.
Right, you probably can't just throw Clorox on a cave wall.
Right, I mean there's plenty of, you know, native biota, fungi and bacteria that are native there that, you know, it's part of the cave ecosystem. You wouldn't want to just completely wipe out that native ecosystem.
And does the same go for treatment of the bats? Like once a bat is found to have white nose syndrome, you can't just, you know, clean the fungus off of them, and there's no cure out there, and there is research underway to try to cure them that way too?
That's exactly right. Again, there are some early signs, some studies showing that there may be ways to at least slow the spread of the fungus and maybe give bats a chance to, you know, not wake up so frequently and make it through the winter, even though they are infected. But they're still in fairly early stages of lab and some really early field trials.
And Jeff Hitchman, can you talk a bit about how researchers think this is being spread at this point? I know Owen kind of touched on it earlier, but just the different ways that researchers are looking at this.
I think there's a couple of different hypotheses out there about how the fungus is getting spread. Again, you're dealing with microscopic fungal spores that can get on bats. So depending when a bat picks up the spores during hibernation. Say, for example, a bat is entering into hibernation, and one of the things that we know that happens is bats mate in the fall, so they might move into a cave or mine temporarily, and then if that's a site that has the fungal spores, and then they move on to another cave or mine that doesn't have the fungal spores and actually hibernate there, that's one scenario that might be spreading the fungus. The degree to which the fungal spores can persist throughout the summer months, I'm not sure where the data is on that. If the spores can land on a bat essentially during the winter time, and if a bat manages to survive that winter hibernation season, if they can sort of reinfect a site the following year, I believe actually some of the folks at the disease lab in Madison may have looked at that or looking into that. And then the other scenario is unintentional spread by humans that might be sort of recreationally caving. If folks are going in to a site that has been infected, or if they're not aware that it might be infected, those individuals could pick up spores again on their clothing, on their boots, on caving equipment, and then if that equipment is not sort of properly disinfected, there's a chance that then they could move that to another site if they would use that same equipment to visit another location.
And Owen, the DNR has been working with mine and cave owners on developing white nose syndrome spread plans, correct?
Correct. Actually, any cave or mine that allows human use or human entry has to have a white nose control plan. And just as Jeff was pointing out, that consists mainly of a plan to essentially make sure that folks aren't using the same clothes, the same equipment, the same shoes in multiple caves or mines, you know, without at least detoxifying those clothes and equipment. We really recommend that folks have dedicated gear, and just so that, you know, the clothes that you wear in one site don't go to a different site. And we've seen that bats don't even need to be present within a site in order for the fungus and the fungal spores to be spread. So whether bats are in a place or not doesn't necessarily mean the cave or mine can't already be infected.
So I'd imagine that, you know, people who are big-time spelunkers, they hopefully are aware of this and are being very mindful of it. But are there any, plans, or is education underway to really get this message out to maybe just recreational hikers, people who might not even think twice, like, oh, whatever, you know, I cleaned off my boots when I got home, I'll be fine next time I go out?
Yeah, and actually that's the purpose of those control plans, is that they're site-specific, and the owner of the cave or mine is responsible for doing that on-site education. And we provide information and brochures and other forms of info for those cave and mine owners to share.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about the spread of white nose syndrome in Wisconsin. My guests are Owen Boyle. He's a species management section chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Jeff Hipschman. He's the professor in Department of Biology at UW-Platteville. So, Jeff, you know, some people out there are scared of bats. Why should people care about, you know, the fact that this is happening to bats?
Lots of folks, thankfully, are becoming aware of the big role that bats play in our ecosystems as essentially free consumers of insects. All of the bats that we have in Wisconsin are insectivorous bats, so they're consuming insects, various species of beetles and small moths are a big part of that. And those insects, you know, are prey of the bats, and they themselves may be predators of various plant species in different ways. So it's sort of a giant ripple effect. If we remove bats or if their numbers decline dramatically, how that will affect insect populations, and then how those insect populations may in turn affect other insect populations or plant populations. So I think one of the big things is we've got kind of a lot of unknowns on the horizon. And one of the things that we can say with certain is there will be an impact, and it could be a very profound impact as we lose these bats that are consuming, you know, tons and tons and tons of insects on a regular basis. And I think, fortunately, again, a lot of folks are aware of that or becoming aware of that. And the economic impacts, I suppose, remain to be seen. But undoubtedly, there will be economic impacts as our bat populations decline.
I imagine it could have a huge impact on the ag industry.
Potentially so. There has been research that some bats, not necessarily bats that we have here in Wisconsin, but are primary consumers of pests that affect cotton crops, for example, in the southern states. Some of the beetles and moth species that may be prey of bats may be forest pests. There are some species of moths that in their larval stage may be boring into different kind of plants and be pest species. And so when the bats are gone and those insect populations decrease, there may be increased damage or an increased economic cost related to the need for more pesticides or more pesticide applications.
Jeff, I'm curious, just with the research that you and the students that you work with, the research that you do, does the emergence of white nose syndrome in Wisconsin, does that change your focus? Or is that something that, you know, maybe in a couple of years you'll focus your attention differently?
The work that I've done here at UW-Platteville, which is an undergraduate institution, started years ago, really before white nose syndrome was even in North America. I've been doing bat work in the state since around 2004. And a lot of it was initially just determining what the bat community looked like in this corner of the state. What were the species present? What were patterns related to reproductive patterns? And when are the young of the year first starting to fly? And one of the motivations, frankly, was to provide undergrads with a great research opportunity to get them out in the field and be involved in a research project. And as the years went on and we were starting to collect a nice baseline data set as to what our bat community looked like here in the state, you know, then we started hearing along with other bat research around the country about white nose syndrome, its initial appearance on the scene and then subsequent spread. And now we've got a scenario where we have years of essentially baseline data, what our bat populations and bat community looks like in this corner of the state, a healthy bat community. And so we're in a position to actually sort of document the changes that may be coming as a result of white nose syndrome. The decline, for example, in these hibernating species is something that we're in a position to see. So at this point, my hope is to continue essentially this long-term study into the foreseeable future and see how things play out.
And Owen, I'm assuming you and other researchers at the DNR probably bracing yourselves as white-nose syndrome was slowly making its way across the U.S. But how is this, you know, now that it's really showing up in Wisconsin slowly, but it's here, how is this changing the work that you and your colleagues do?
Yeah, at this point, it really doesn't change things too significantly. As Jeff mentioned, you know, we've got this really great these surveys and have an idea of the baseline sort of pre-disease populations and distribution of the species in the state. And one of the really important reasons to continue that monitoring through the progression of the disease and hopefully afterward, you know, ideally if populations start to recover or if treatments are developed that help allow populations to recover, you know, we'll be able to track that and be able to quantify not only how populations are recovering, but how they're responding to potential treatment or white nose control measures.
And Owen, you said earlier that you all are anticipating that, you know, this will be killing off bats as the years go along. Is there anything that can be done in the meantime just to prevent the spread or just the different deaths? Is it waiting on research and waiting on a cure?
While we're waiting on research for, you know, control and treatment options, again, we continue to monitor the various species and their populations. We continue to, a number of those programs are citizen-based monitoring programs, and so we recruit and train volunteers to go out and, for example, count bats at roost sites in the summer, and it's actually a lot of fun. You sit outside with your family as the sun is setting and count bats as they come out for a night of eating insects. And another project is where folks go out and carry these really high-tech gadgets that actually collect, they're able to hear the ultrasonic sounds that bats make as they're hunting those insects. And they carry those the equipment around, and from the data they collect, we can actually identify the species of bats that are flying overhead while they were doing that survey. And so those two are really important pieces of that overall picture of the population health of bats in Wisconsin. We already mentioned limiting the spread or the potential spread of the fungus. One other thing folks can do is to build roost boxes and put them up in good bat habitat. And, you know, so bats still need a place to go in the summer to have their young and raise those pups.
If people know they have bats in their attic or if someone has an old barn that bats live in, is there anything they should be concerned about?
No, there's nothing to be concerned about. If they have those roosts, it would be great. They could get on the DNR website and search for bats, and they can actually sign up and be a new site to be a roost monitor.
Jeff, I'm wondering if, just as we're kind of coming to a close, is there any other research you want to talk about that's underway that you hadn't mentioned before, or anything else that, you know, you and your students are looking at?
As I mentioned, mostly at this point, we're continuing the long-term monitoring. I would like to say, partly because of our location here in Platteville, I've been fortunate, and my students have been fortunate, to form some great partnerships with some of the folks within the Wisconsin DNR BAT program. One project right along the lines of what Owen was just mentioning that students will be involved with is monitoring a local barn where there is a known summer bat roost, and the landowners have graciously allowed us to come out and track that population, so the students will be involved in emergent counts there. We've also marked a lot of those bats with little essentially microchips called pit tags. A lot of folks have their dogs and cats marked with these pit tags. Your vet may have done it, so it provides a unique identification number, and essentially you wave kind of a wand over the bat, and you can see if they've been tagged, and the number comes up. In this particular barn, where the bats are roosting, the students can go into the barn. The bats are on the other side of the wall, really between an original wall and some metal siding, and can keep track of individual bats as they're moving around. And one of the things we're doing is just kind of tracking some individuals over a matter of years, and also kind of just exploring this marking technique. So that's been a great opportunity for students, and again, a great partnership that we've been able to develop with the Bat Crew in the Wisconsin DNR.
Owen, is there anything else that you want to talk about or that you want people to know just regarding white nose syndrome and our bat population here in Wisconsin?
I'd reiterate that, first of all, white nose syndrome is not a threat to people. It's not a human health issue. People can't get it. Other animals can't get it. It's strictly in our bats. You know, if you do head underground, please check in with that landowner and see what their white nose control plan says, and follow the information that they provide.
Owen Doyle is a species management section chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jeff Hipschman is a biology professor at UW-Platteville. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's Maureen McCullum about the spread of the often lethal white nose syndrome and its impact on bats in southwestern Wisconsin's Driftless region. Coming up, we move to western Wisconsin's Jackson County, where efforts to reestablish a herd of elk have felt some recent setbacks. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to additional information about white-nosed syndrome in Wisconsin. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share a comment or make suggestions for future shows, you can find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. After years of planning, a small herd of elk was relocated from Kentucky to the Jackson County forests near Black River Falls in late March of this year. Elk are native to western Wisconsin and historically could be found in much of the state, but development and loss of habitat changed that. This new effort hopes to reverse those circumstances, and the Jackson County herd is just the second reintroduced in the state, joining an elk herd that was established years ago in northern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis discussed these latest developments with Wisconsin DNR big game specialist Kevin Wallenfang.
We've been on a roller coaster ride for the last several months, and we really have not established a herd in Jackson County yet. We have elk there. They are ready to be released, pending their final health tests that are coming up here in June. But until that all happens and we get clearance, those animals will remain in the pen. Like I said, we've been kind of riding a roller coaster. We started out absolutely perfect. Then we hit a little bit of a road bump with the loss of some elk, but we seem to be back on track now and are optimistic for the rest of the way here.
So how do you define when a herd is reestablished?
Well, the elk that we have are actually still in a pen. And, you know, the goal is to get these animals. They are, you know, they're wild elk. They were captured from the wild in Kentucky, free-ranging animals. And, they are still in a pen. So we don't consider that, on the landscape, of course, yet. They are pending final health tests, and, you know, there's always something that could possibly go wrong there. And, worst-case scenario, the animals don't actually get released. So, our long-term goal for Jackson County is to have about 400 elk on the ground. So that's going to take, you know, several years to get to that point. But we feel, you know, confident that that can happen. It's great country there. It's good habitat for elk. Lots of open space, lots of nice woods, and plenty to eat there. So we're optimistic, but, you know, until we actually have a self-sustaining viable herd there in the county, that's what we look at as to a successful reintroduction effort. We're not going to know, you know, the final outcome of this thing for quite some time. We've had elk in Clam Lake. This is the 20th anniversary of having elk up in the Clam Lake area. And we're still, you know, we're still riding somewhat of a roller coaster up there. Population has overall increased over time. But then, you know, you always get little setbacks. We had a pretty good one here a couple of years ago, the winter of 2013 and 14 that was so hard on wildlife around the state was very hard on the elk population. So we've had a dip in those numbers. And, you know, that's kind of part of the ball game. But that herd is pretty well established. It's not going anywhere, but there's more that we can do for it to help it thrive as it was always intended to.
There were some deaths in the elk that came from Kentucky earlier this month. I know you're not the health professional, but could you talk a little bit about what happened to those elk?
Yeah, unfortunately, we lost five animals to a tick-borne disease called babesiosis. It's a fairly common disease around the country. It has been documented before, and it has been documented in Wisconsin before. So this is not, it's not something new. It has affected captive cervid animals in the state. There's one situation in particular where a game farm situation had caribou, and they lost, I'm not sure if it was all of them or most of them or what the situation was, but so it is a disease that is known to Wisconsin. It was not something that we really expected to smack any of our elk the way that it did, but it was out there, and to the credit of our health staff, they had it on their radar screen right from the start, but, you know, it's a very difficult disease to diagnose, and so it ended up, they sent samples out to several different labs in other states and did finally narrow it down and pinpoint it. So it happened very quickly, and, you know, the other confusing part of it is that it happened at a time where you would anticipate if you were going to lose animals just from stress, it all happened at about the same time. So, you know, losing some animals is part of the whole game. It's unfortunate and disheartening when it happens, but it is common and has to be expected. So when we lost these animals, it was probably a combination of both the stress of the whole situation for the animals and then on top of it getting this tick-borne disease.
So is the rest of the herd that's there, are they susceptible to this now?
It's very difficult for us to know how many of those animals have been exposed to it. You know, we have hopes that we're kind of out of the woods here because they all happened. All of the five deaths happened in a very, very short period, within about a week. And, you know, it's probably likely that some of the other animals that are there have now been exposed to it, but it's, you know, it's difficult for us to say that. So it appears that we're out of the woods, but you never know.
Are you taking precautions to protect the rest of the herd, or can't you really do that?
Yeah, our veterinary staff tells me that, you know, there's really no way to vaccine for it, but they do have a plan in place that if an animal starts to show similar symptoms, they have a plan as to how to address that with antibiotics and whatnot. We do have a sick bay as part of our pen complex, so that if we get an animal that appears to have something wrong with it, we can kind of corral that animal into a different part of the pen by itself and try to treat it. So, you know, there's just not been a lot of experience out there with this, with the disease. You know, it gets tricky when you're working with wild animals, and we can't even say that this has not affected our Clam Lake herd. The problem is that you need a very fresh animal. And when an animal, you know, dies out in the wild, it gets scavenged by a variety of predators and whatnot, and it takes a while to find that carcass, and by the time you do, there's usually nothing left. So this is kind of a unique situation where we have fresh carcasses that can actually be, you know, looked at very closely.
They're in a pen in Jackson County?
Yes, the requirements of reintroducing elk to Wisconsin and importing them to Wisconsin is that they had to have a 120-day quarantine period where we would test them for a variety of diseases that are primarily aimed at preventing tuberculosis and brucellosis because of our cattle industry and our captive cervid industry in the state. So 120-day quarantine period started, I believe, February 7th or February 9th, and that will be up here in early June. So the animals will go through one more testing, round of health testing, They will get radio collars, tracking collars, put on each animal before they are released out into the wild so that we can monitor them, figure out, you know, all kinds of things, birth rates and survival rates and, you know, habitat preferences and all those kind of things. So there's a lot of research actually going on with this project as well.
They will be released in the wild in June if all goes well.
Correct.
What is involved with that?
Not a lot. We open the gates and we walk away. It's a very, very calm experience for the elk. The biggest key to this entire project is to reduce stress on the animals as much as you possibly can. So, you know, when the animals arrived, we didn't have 1,000 people standing around and cheering or anything like that because that all adds stress. So the release itself will be much the same way. The pens will be opened up, and the elk will be able to walk out whenever it suits them. And some may come out immediately. Others may, you know, they may be in the pen for a couple of days with the doors wide open because they feel secure there. So you see a variety of different behavior when you do something like this, but we leave it up to the animals as to when they want to go.
Talk a little bit about the habitat where the elk will be and why it's good for the elk.
Well, the location of where the pen is right now is on State Forest property, just east of the city of Black River Falls. But there is quite a bit of county forest out there as well. So, you know, our goal is to try to have most of these animals on public property so that they can be enjoyed by everybody, because there is quite a significant tourism benefit to having these animals out there. Local communities tend to see lots of people coming, wanting to view the elk and that sort of thing, hearing them bugle in the fall. So it is primarily public land. There is some private properties mixed in. But the habitat itself is really significantly different from what we have up in Clam Lake, where it's primarily a forested area. Down in Jackson County, you have sandy soils with a lot of pine and jack pine, primarily kind of scrubby oak, puts out a lot of acorns in that country. You have a lot of open areas, grassy areas, marshlands and whatnot. You know, some of this is habitat that is very similar to what Carnard blue butterflies, for example, use in Wisconsin. So it's, you know, central forest habitat that we think is going to be very, very good for elk.
Are you concerned about the public and the elk coming in contact?
Let's keep in mind, for starters, that the reason elk are being put out there is for the public. There's a lot of support behind this. We have actually done surveys and polls and whatnot out there ourselves. And, you know, we tend to see 85 to 90% public acceptance of what is happening here. So the public would like to see it happen for all the reasons that I mentioned earlier. But, you know, with any kind of wildlife out there, there's always the possibility that an animal is going to get into some sort of trouble, whether that be in crops or hit on the highway or whatever. Long before the elk ever arrived there, in fact, years and years ago, the whole situation was really assessed around the state, and there were pockets that were felt to be best areas to put elk, and the Jackson County forest area was one of those. You know, elk in the eastern part of the United States tend to not wander very far. So unlike their western cousins where, you know, they'll make a 20 or 30 mile move overnight, we don't find that. And all of the eastern states pretty much find the same thing, that when you put these animals in a location, for the most part, they tend to stay there. So, for example, up in Clam Lake, most of the animals are still within, you know, 4, 5, 6 miles of where they were originally released in Clam Lake. So we don't expect that they're going to go real far. You know, you do get exceptions to that, and you'll have one that suddenly decides to go cross-country. But so if they stay, for the most part, out in the area where they're being released, we think that our, you know, any kind of potential problems are going to be held to a minimum.
What is an elk's diet like, and what kind of damage do you expect them to do to agriculture? And will farmers be reimbursed for those losses?
You know, elk will eat any kind of a crop out there, so they will take advantage of cornfields and alfalfa fields and things like that if the opportunity is there. But again, like I said, that was all looked at prior to putting these animals out there to try to minimize that risk of that happening. So again, if they stay put where we are hoping that they where they are being released, those problems will be very much minimized. But Wisconsin does have a program already in place that covers elk damage. So if elk were to get into a cranberry bog situation or something like that, we do have the ability already in place to reimburse a farmer for that damage. We have the ability to go in and trap and move that animal if we need to, or, you know, whatever the situation may be, we have the ability to eliminate the problem itself. So, again, you know, we're trying to minimize that risk right from the start. Many of the cranberry growers, for example, are already enrolled in some way in the wildlife damage program because they have used abatement tactics to keep deer out of their bogs. So many of those bogs are already fenced, and that fence will also be effective on elk. You know, there's always the possibility, again, that one may get hit by a car or something like that. That has happened also up in the Clam Lake area. Luckily, we have not had anybody hurt, but, you know, it is a possibility.
The elk come from an agreement with the state of Kentucky. Could you talk a little bit about that agreement, what is involved with that?
Yeah, we have an agreement with them that we will be allowed to capture and relocate up to 50 animals each year for up to as many as 5 years. So we have a 3 to 5 year agreement. You know, we were hoping that we could go down there and catch 50 elk each year and get it done as quickly as possible. But as we learned this year, conditions didn't allow that to happen. We didn't end up with 50. So, but we have this agreement in place. We can take 50 per year. And in exchange for those elk, we are working with them on some grouse habitat projects that they have in their state. Just like we would like to see our elk population increase, they would like to see grouse numbers come back in their state. So we're working with them on that. But, you know, this first year, we just had such a great relationship going into this. We had a couple of different capture teams from Wisconsin go down to Kentucky and work side by side with their staff. You know, they've done this for a few years now for other states and successfully reintroduced elk to Virginia and Missouri most recently. So we are working side by side with them, living with them, eating with them, spending 24 hours a day with them on this, you know, combined capture effort. And for the most part, things went extremely well down there. We didn't have anybody get hurt or anything like that. And those were really that was our top priority. But, you know, they're providing staff to the effort. We're providing staff to the effort. So, you know, there's a lot of little pieces to that overall agreement. But basically what it comes right down to is elk for grouse.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking about the reestablishment of elk in Jackson County, something that happened in late March and has been a long time in coming. Our guest is Wisconsin DNR big game specialist Kevin Wallenfang. Kevin, it's probably important to note that before there were a lot of people in Wisconsin, there were a lot of elk, weren't there?
Yeah, elk were common here. We have either written records or bone fragment and antler records in at least 50 of Wisconsin's 72 counties. So elk were common here. They were, you know, primarily a plains animal. But lots of situations around the state where we had them, primarily in the southern and western part of the state.
Now, what became of the elk? Why did they disappear?
Yeah, like so many critters out there, you know, as people moved in and started to settle the area, you know, there was unregulated hunting. So they saw elk and deer and buffalo and other critters in Wisconsin as a food source. And, you know, a lot of it really comes down to the loss of habitat as agriculture got more predominant around the state. More of that beautiful prairie got plowed under to plant crops. So goes the habitat, so goes the animals. So elk disappeared from Wisconsin by the late 1800s.
How common are they in the U.S. today?
I believe that more than half the states in the country have elk. Many of the western states have tens of thousands of elk, you know, very high numbers of them. And there's been a significant number of states in the eastern half of the United States that have successfully reintroduced elk. So along with Wisconsin, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, certainly Kentucky has been the biggest success story there probably. So quite a few states actually have elk, and several more looking to do the same.
You just started this effort in Jackson County, but what is the ultimate goal for that herd, and how long could it take to realize that goal?
In Jackson County, our overall goal is about 400 animals. You know, how long it takes to get there, I could not say.
It sounds like it might take a while.
Yeah, very well may, but, you know, if the conditions are different there, as we are hoping that they will be, we are hoping that we see fewer losses to predators, fewer losses to car accidents, things like that, that have happened up in the Clam Lake area. I mean, we've had some strange situations, actually, in Clam Lake. We had a whole herd of them once fall through the Chippewa River, and four or five of them died. So, you know, you get freak accidents like that that can set back your herd growth a bit. But we're hoping it happens quite a bit quicker. And one of the keys to that is that we're starting with more animals. If we had started that population with 150, we would be at our overall goal of 1,400 by now based on the type of growth rates that we've seen for that population. So, you know, we're trying to start the Jackson County herd with 75 animals. It took, I want to say, 7 or 8 years to get to 75 in Jackson County. It may have even been more than that. So putting more animals out there from the start is our goal, and hopefully it'll make it happen quicker.
You've mentioned tracking a couple of times. What does that involve, and what are you looking for, I guess, as you track them?
Well, it involves putting a radio collar on each animal. So they're going to wear a collar around their neck that actually sends out a signal. Twice a day, it sends us a location. So it's a GPS collar, and it just sends a location to a computer twice a day. And so, you know, that's just kind of general monitoring that we do to look at where they're spending their time, how close they are to situations, as you mentioned earlier, that might get them into trouble. But more importantly, you know, what kind of habitats they're using. We also have requirements with the Department of Agriculture to track these animals for 5 years after they are released for disease monitoring purposes. So there's a little bit of that involved as well. But by following these animals, you know, you learn where they're giving birth. You're able to track the animal and actually go in and find the calf. So you can make determinations as to, you know, where they're, what kind of habitat they prefer to have that calf in, how healthy the calf itself is, whether that calf survives or not. All of that information helps us build population models to continue to know, you know, so we will need to know when we do get to that 400 animals out there. Those kind of things are important to monitor when you're trying to determine if there should be a hunting season or not. So you learn an awful lot by following these animals around, and we'll do that. It'll be quite simple, twice a day. Like I said, twice a day we're going to get a location on them.
And will there be routine health checkups?
Well, we don't go and round the animals up and check them, but when an animal dies, we get as much information from that as we possibly can. So, you know, if an animal is out on the landscape and doing well, we assume that it's healthy. But when an animal dies, you know, every animal in Wisconsin gets tested for chronic wasting disease, and they, you know, they get a full necropsy to try to determine what they died from, what kind of condition they were in when they died, whatnot.
You mentioned hunting. I assume we're a long way from that in Wisconsin. But if you eventually reach your goals with these herds, are we going to be talking about an elk hunting season?
Yeah, elk hunting is one of those recreational opportunities that is included in the management plans for both areas. We currently have set numbers in place as to when a hunt could take place. That number in Clam Lake is 200, and we were actually very, very close a couple of years ago, but like I said, we got hit with that tough winter, and it knocked our population back, so it may be a few years before we get back to that level. But the current numbers are 200 in Clam Lake and 150 in Jackson County. Now, whether those hunts actually begin when those animals hit 200 or 150, you know, that's something that we review annually. And again, that's why those population estimates and monitoring those animals and coming up with population modeling techniques is so important to what we do.
What does this program cost annually for both the taxpayer and also from donations from local programs?
Well, there's multiple levels to that question. So for the most part, the everyday taxpayer doesn't pay anything into this because it's paid for primarily through money that comes through hunting and fishing licenses and grants and things like that from the sale of hunting and, you know, bullets and guns and things like that. The project that we are taking on right now to reintroduce the animals, we've got a price tag on of about $600,000, and that money is coming all from private funding sources. So we've got the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation out there, the Jackson County Wildlife Fund I had already mentioned, the Ho-Chunk Nation there in Black River Falls has been a big part of this. We have also received money from, you know, other sources. The Chippewa tribes annually put money into it through tribal gaming funds. So overall, you know, the general elk program itself is about a $200,000 a year program, and those costs are probably going to go up a bit now that we've got another herd in Jackson County.
Kevin Wallenfang, he's a big game specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, speaking with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about plans underway to reestablish an elk herd in Jackson County here in western Wisconsin. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to the DNR's elk reintroduction website. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. Our website also includes links to other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff, that and more, at WPR.org/newsmakers. And a reminder that you can learn more and like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.